You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Texas becomes the latest jurisdiction to try to turn the battle against COVID-19 into a culture war showdown. An imminent cold or expensive winter prompts discussion across Europe about the future of energy, and Korean and Japanese media trade barbs over a controversial curry. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily, in association with Allianz, starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Julie Norman and Somnath Battabile, will discuss all the day's big stories, and we will continue our 10th anniversary countdown of the 100 most memorable moments of Monocle 24's first decade on air. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Julie Norman, lecturer in politics and international relations at UCL, and by Somnath Battabile, lecturer in media development and international journalism at SOAS, University of London. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Just by way of cunningly foreshadowing the last story, I don't want to get into the particular controversy right now, but have either of you ever been involved in the preparation, consumption, or contemplation of a controversial dish?
Oh, yes. I have definitely been involved in the consumption of hummus. And the hummus wars between Lebanon and Israel are classic. It culminated in a 10,000-kilogram pot of hummus being made by Lebanon to end the war. But I think it's still ongoing in some ways.
Do you want to pick a side between those two and thereby ensure a full inbox for about the next 6 weeks?
I think I would just say I love all the hummuses that I've been presented with.
Feeble. Pusillanimous. Somnath, do you want to pick a side in the hummus or any other war while you're sitting there?
I make a mean hummus there. That's the story.
Wow. Okay.
Really good one.
So you are basically sitting there by yourself and saying, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, to the entire Middle East.
Oh, gosh. That's a tough one. I'm going to let that pass.
Probably wisely. We will return to that and other subjects later in the show. But first, to Afghanistan, which has been the subject of a G20 video conference, i.e. a conclave of pretty much all the countries which decided to give abruptly up on Afghanistan about 6 weeks ago. It appears to have dawned on all concerned that Afghanistan's problems, one, have worsened, and two, are unlikely to solve themselves. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Chris, do we know what prompted this sudden reignition of interest in the fortunes of Afghanistan?
Well, in some ways, you touched on it, the increasingly dire situation that Afghanistan is facing. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that Afghanistan was essentially near breaking point. He called for aid, but also liquidity for the country, with its banks essentially in danger of closing. So that's really what prompted this meeting by G20 leaders, called by Mario Draghi, also the heads of international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, who are sort of waiting on the sidelines also for money to be unlocked. A big part of this is also about, in that sense, how you deal with the Taliban. So there's a lot of questions about money that the US and the UK are waiting on and whether they will release that to the Taliban. I should also add on that, notably absent from the meeting were China's Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin. They apparently chose not to dial in and sent foreign ministers in their place. I think that goes to show in itself how difficult some of this is. They've kind of all asked for financial aid, everything to be released without conditions, and that's something that the US and Western leaders are struggling to do.
So what actually has been agreed and or offered?
Well, so agreed and essentially was financial aid pledges. The European Union in particular offered another 700 million euros in aid. What is key here is that for Mario Draghi and others, this aid should not go directly to the Taliban, but instead it's being dispensed by UN agencies and other international aid organizations. That's sort of where, if you will, the key sticking point is. Mario Draghi talked about afterwards saying there was unanimous agreement among the participants about the need to tackle Afghanistan's mounting humanitarian crisis. and safeguard the position of women in this impoverished nation. And therein lies the rub about how you do this, how you go about it. So there was a lot of financial aid agreed at this point, not so much agreement on what to do with the Taliban, whether to provide them with any kind of direct aid or talks in order to really get this country back up and running.
Was there any thinly veiled subtext of countries desperately hoping that some sort of leverage can be obtained with the Taliban, i.e. that they will moderate their behaviour somewhat in return for the largesse they are seeking?
There has been some effort towards that. It's been particularly really from the European Union, as I say, when you listen to Mario Draghi a little bit there talking about the position of women. What's interesting is that even the US seems to have a little bit less of an interest in doing this to almost relitigate the past. They kind of want to wash their hands of it to some degree and provide only emergency aid. The other side of this, it should be, as I mentioned, with Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping not being there, are China and Russia. They are pushing for sanctions to be lifted and a quicker resolution to this. They're also, Russia is going to host its own meeting on October 20th, also inviting Pakistan and Iran, other neighbors that were not invited to this meeting, to form their own sort of process and also even bring the Taliban into these talks. So it'll be interesting to see how the approaches differ between that summit and what we saw today.
Chris Chermak, thank you for joining us. And we'll now bring in our panel, Julie Norman and Somnath Batabayal, and we will start in the United States, where, as elsewhere, almost all battles in the modern culture wars are essentially idiotic, but most at least have the redeeming virtue of being about basically nothing. It has required a special kind of stupidity to attempt to conduct such a row over a morally indifferent force of nature, but American politicians in particular have risen to that challenge. Among the most prominent is Greg Abbott, Republican governor of Texas, who has issued an executive order banning all vaccine mandates in the state, public or private. 68,000 Texans have died since the pandemic began. Greg Abbott represents, of course, the Republican Party, the party of business, the party of libertarianism, the party of letting the market decide, but he's now come out against private companies making their own decisions.
He certainly has, and this really isn't a big surprise from someone like Abbott. What's interesting with him, though, is he has said, even in this latest announcement, that he believes that vaccines are the best way to combat COVID and to control the virus.
In fairness to him, he has said that, and he has also credited them with saving him from COVID, which he has had.
Exactly, and just this summer. So he, in that way, we can kind of see that there is some rationality there, and yet we really see him playing to the base of the party by pushing back at Biden's mandate with saying, you know, we're going to go the opposite way and ban these vaccine mandates. There's going to be primaries coming up. He's going to be challenged by people who are more in the Trump era or part of the party coming up this spring. So we can see this as a nod in that direction.
Somnath, is this indicative of the bind that the Republican Party has now got itself into, which is that you can't get nominated anymore for senior roles in the Republican Party unless you pretend to be crazy? And you do end up getting essentially imprisoned by your base. As Julie points out, what Governor Abbott is frightened of is being primaried by the full-blown Yahoo wing of the GOP before next year's gubernatorial election.
Yeah, true. And the New York Times reports about a couple of months back that he also has presidential ambitions. So he is playing to grassroots party members. And again, this is a climb down from what his earlier position was. In March last year, when he did go against the grassroots, there was a huge backlash. And his focus groups obviously told him that if he has to come up for governor next year, then he needs to change policies. And that's what he's doing. You put it very well, that do you have to be crazy to be a politician these days in one particular party in the US? It seems like this because though he knows, he believes, he says that this is the science, this is what saved him, yet the mandate is do not bother, I'll not let anyone dictate in front of personal responsibility. That's what his office is saying, that everyone should be responsible for their own lives. But the basic problem with that theory is that social contract says that your actions cannot infringe on someone else's well-being. And here with COVID, if you do not take the vaccine, you might be responsible for spreading it.
But Julie, it reminds me of the sort of willful obtuseness with which people of Greg Abbott's general tendency also approach issues of freedom of speech. You know, for example, when President Trump got booted off Twitter and Facebook, there was much anguish that his freedom of speech had been abridged, and it hadn't. It was a private company making its own decisions, which is what Republicans are supposed to be heartily in favour of. Why don't more of their voters notice that they're trying to have it both ways?
Well, I think we see both parties in some ways trying to have it both ways with the free speech argument. And in fact, there's not really consensus along party lines about where to draw the lines on social media companies and where to have the regulations. And even something like Twitter, I think there were some valid questions. As happy as I was not to see Trump's tweets every day, there are many other quite vile individuals who are still on Twitter and are not taken off and censored. So I think it does raise some very important questions that we need to have around dangerous speech. But you're right that the Republican Party tends to lean into those contradictions pretty strongly.
It isn't just in the United States, of course, that we have seen COVID-19 become a culture war issue. It has been much the same here in the United Kingdom, where you can see certain contortions among the conservative press in that this has been a conservative government trying to preside during this, but you've had conservative columnists going, varying on the spectrum for just being, mildly libertarian to full-blown tinfoil hat crank. But does it strike you as weird that this has happened over, as we've been saying, a force of nature which just could not care less?
How does one answer that? I mean, one of the basic principles, I think, which, as you say, COVID couldn't care less and people will die unless and until the state steps in. This does forcefully step into another thing which at least the global West and the way post-18th century enlightenment, what has happened, it infringes on many personal liberties. And the right of the center doesn't like that. And it wants to protect that territory very strongly. The last 50, 60 years, post-war, there has been no time where the state had to interfere in the West so strongly against personal liberty. So I understand that worry that if this is allowed to happen, what more might happen? But again, given that millions have been affected, hundreds of thousands have died in the West, it's one situation where rationality has to prevail and science has to prevail.
Well, we shall see if that shows any sign of happening. But here in the UK, those of us who refuse grimly to switch the heating on in October are beginning to wonder if our resolve and our constitutions will survive long into November, possibly beyond. Consumers have been warned to expect the kind of energy bills likely to prompt idle thoughts of burning spare furniture, a crunch caused by a confluence of factors economic, political, and natural. Various governments have reassured that this is a freakish and temporary glitch, and this may even be true as opposed to craven self-preservation, but will it or should it cause us to think differently about energy? I will ask you both in turn, Julie, first, have you bought extra cardigans for this winter?
Well, I think I'm pretty well stocked, but I've got to say, we were speaking before, and I think we're all kind of saving our pennies a little bit for rising rates, but we'll see. I mean, I was like, I'm not panicking yet. And I'm like you, Andrew, I feel somewhat confident that this is partially a blip. I think part of it is just coming out of COVID. Everything just feels uncertain and somewhat unprecedented. And it seems very rational to me that there was going to be supply chain issues, that there was going to be just odd things coming out of this period. So while that might just be me hoping I don't need to break out the cardigans, but I'm not in crisis mode yet, even though perhaps I should be.
And Somnath, have you begun laying in firewood?
I haven't. I have in-laws, a huge house and a lot of firewood there. So I'll probably retire if something goes wrong. But I kind of slightly disagree with Julie on this, if I may, Julie, that I think there were clear signals, and this might be the way we see the future of the crisis, which will keep happening again and again. 50% of our energy comes from fossil fuels in the UK. Mm-hmm. couple of things happened. One was the nuclear power plants started shutting down in the UK because they were getting older and older. Only one is coming up. Four will be shut down this year. Hinkley is the only one which has been replaced. Our supply from France, the power cable caught fire. That was cut off. And since 1961, this has been the last 3-4 months, we have had the least amount of wind in the UK. And so the energy from turbines went down heavily. So these things were predictable. You could see these, except the wind, perhaps you could see what was happening. That is one. You also knew coming out of COVID, there'll be a huge surge, at least in the global south, for power. That's what happened in China, about 8.3% increase. So the lot of the stuff which was coming in from Qatar stopped coming to Europe. Would Russia play games? You know what Russian state policy has been. So that was another thing, that Gazprom probably will not increase flow of gas into Europe. So all of this have collided. Have we done anything? Did we prepare? No. Will this happen again? Yes, given the situation, yes, every time, year on year and more. Have you invested in science? Have you invested in new technology? Really, no. Where is Boris Johnson? In Spain having a holiday.
That right there, though, Julie, the investment, is that part of the problem that we're now in, well, one hopes a transition from a fossil fuel energy economy to a renewable energy economy. And so there's less investment available for shoring up the fossil fuel infrastructure because nobody thinks that's the future. Nobody wants to invest something in something that nobody's going to be using in 30 years.
Well, yeah, I think what's happening now has really, you can see it both ways of how to view this crisis. I mean, some see it as undergirding the need to continue to invest in fossil fuels, saying that we obviously still need this energy and need to be having these different options for input, whereas others are saying, look, these traditional outputs obviously aren't doing enough. We need to be investing more in whether it's nuclear or turbines or what have you. So I think you can read that either way. You know, all of this is coming up right on the cusp of the COP conference that's going to be taking place in November in just a couple of weeks, with, you know, the whole world kind of meeting to talk about climate and environmental future. So I think energy will be much more of a central part of that agenda than we probably would have expected even a month or two ago with these current shortages.
Hey, Somnath, we have spoken many times to our various guests on this program about how nothing ever seems to stick to Boris Johnson. He is just one of those extraordinarily blessed politicians who can saunter through crisis after crisis without ever being blamed for any of them, even the ones he's caused, especially the ones he's caused. If, however, this winter is properly grim, and all jokes aside, a significant hike in heating bills will mean serious difficulties for many millions of people in this country, could that change, well, this is a horrible local radio segue, but I'm going to do it anyway. Could that change the political temperature?
I think the political temperature is already changing. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of pressure from the Tories about what Boris Johnson is doing. The business has already mentioned in his last speech that there's no proper policies. It's a very lightweight speech that he gave about, you know. So I think there is a push already. Whether he'll be able to come out of it, I think so. He manages this every time, as you said, that, you know, nothing sticks to him. But I hope there is a whole-scale effort to change and invest in long-term, especially on the environment front. But I don't know if there'll be a change in parties in power. I don't know if the Labour comes or any other party comes, whether they'll actually be able to do policies which really mean sustainable, you know, long-term investment in environment, working against climate change. We can't, I don't, you know, there's no easy way to answer that. That's what I'm trying to say. But the one thing I'm afraid of is that Boris has all the charm, the way, manners of speaking, which caters to quick, easy, glib media headlines, and he will be able to get away with it again.
Okay, well, let's continue.
And I also don't want a very miserable winter. Though I want him out, I don't want a miserable winter.
We will continue now with our highlight for this show of the 100 best moments from Monocle 24, which is part of our celebrations of our 10-year anniversary this week. For this instalment, London's Michelin-starred restaurant, the River Cafe, has topped the Monocle Restaurant Awards several times over the years, and its head, Ruth Rogers, has appeared on Monocle 24 on many occasions. This is an excerpt from the time she sat down with Tyler Brulé for the big interview.
We've worked with suppliers over the last 30 years. We have some suppliers that we've still worked with that we, when Rose and I opened the first day. And it's a really close relationship. One of the butchers once said to somebody else, one of the most terrifying calls was ever from Rose or myself saying, you know, that wasn't up to it. You know, we're sending it back. I mean, mm-hmm. How dare you? But that's the negative. We also call them up. We get a fantastic box of mushrooms, or we have langoustine that come from Aberdeen. Most of our ingredients, we source our fish and our meat locally. So it comes from the waters around Devon, Cornwall. We have, nothing is flown in. I think probably nothing comes by plane except our wine and our mozzarella from Naples, which comes in twice a week. Everything else comes from the Milan market. We have to depend on the Milan market. We can't just depend on the British vegetable season, or we'd be quite limited.
And I'm fascinated by that. So that is someone there picking for you, or yeah. are there suppliers who just know that they will send you some? Okay.
Yeah, we go to Milan. I go to Milan two or three times a year, go to the market, talk to the person who chooses. But we use Natura, La Credenza. We have people who are we can trust. And they know. So the boxes come in. They call up and they say, we have, you know, yellow peppers are just coming in, or the small peas, or the, well, we can actually buy English peas as well, you know, which is very exciting and wonderful. But we have ingredients that come in from the market. They're brought in, and then we have somebody who checks every box sure. every morning. And the head chef is there, and they will come with, say, do you want to take these broad beans? Look, they're bigger and they are more floury. And we'll say, yeah, because we can use them in something else that we could make a soup out of them, or no, send them back. Mm. And then we take broad beans off the menu. People come to the River Cafe and say, sometimes in January, and say, I want it. This is an Italian restaurant. Where's my tomato salad? And we go, sorry. Or people say, I ate here last week and I had, you know, we've had real problems getting squid at the moment. We change the menu twice a day.
Sure.
You know, so right now I'm working tonight and I'll go in at 3:00 and I know what's on. I know that I will have 3 fish and meat, and I know one of them. The last 3 months we couldn't fish sea bass because the good old EU, you know, the European Union said it's not sustainable and there was a ban on sea bass. So, which I liked. Bring them on. Bring on those rules. You know, more for them. So it's changing all the time.
So is there a truck once every 2 weeks or once a week that comes from Milan? Or?
Oh, no, much more often. I think it comes 2 or 3 times a week, yeah.
And you know, is that incredible that here we're talking about a world-famous market that exists in Milan and also all the great things an open market brings you as well? And
exactly.
to imagine that exactly. suddenly that those trucks can't come 2 or 3 times a week, or they will still come, but there will be potentially tariffs on them. And I think this moment of this lack of leadership, but also this moment of indecision that we sit in is quite remarkable.
Yeah. No, I've had a really, I mean, for us, Europe has been crucial, you know, and with our ingredients, with our links to Italy. And as I said, I don't want to make this into a case for the EU, the rules they have on health and hygiene are great. You know, I've really, people say, oh, it's a bureaucracy and they do all these terrible things. For me, in my business, it's been really positive.
Mm.
Ruth Rogers from the River Cafe speaking to Tyler Brulé. Remember also that the pinnacle of our 10th anniversary celebrations is the Monocle Media Summit here in London on Thursday evening, which will include a live broadcast from the venue of this show, The Daily. And you would not want to miss that. You are listening to this Monocle Daily, and I will be back with more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie Doha Besancenot is the Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France. Marie Doha Besancenot, it's great to talk with you. What about climate change? How does that fit into Allianz's thinking?
I would say today, as a company, if you don't have a climate plan, you don't have a business plan anymore. This applies to all businesses, of course, but we as insurers have firsthand knowledge of the damage caused by climate change and how much it costs. So we know the world will no longer be insurable if global warming is not kept under control. So we want to contribute to that control. So Allianz has set itself clear steps towards achieving the 1.5 degree target, which was the target of the Paris Climate Agreement. And we share our expertise with other companies, so companies that we partner with, companies we invest in, to help them achieve this goal too. So as corporate citizens, we strive, as any citizen would do, to reduce the carbon footprint produced by our operations. We do it worldwide in 70 countries simultaneously, which means that we can have a real impact. And we keep setting ourselves more and more ambitious goals. So, for example, between 2010 and 2020, we reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by over 60%. And we recently set ourselves a further reduction target of 30% by 2025. So how do we achieve this? Well, there are many ways. Luckily, we can make our data centers more efficient energy-wise. We increase the share of renewable power in our energy mix. And by 2023, there is a global Allianz commitment that we will be using only renewable power for our operations around the world. At Allianz France, I'm proud to say we've already reached that goal and started using only locally produced green gas as of 2020. And the good thing is that it means our all suppliers are actually following these high standards we're setting for them.
How do ESG risks and opportunities play a part in Allianz investment and insurance?
Well, to be honest, insurance is not a high emissions industry. So the way we can have an impact is mainly through investments. So ESG principles guide the way we invest simply because we believe that companies that prioritize sustainability lead to better long-term outcomes. So one thing we do is we choose our asset managers based on their commitment to ESG principles, and we evaluate them continuously to ensure that they fully integrate these practices. Then, in a nutshell, there are three ways we can implement our ESG ambitions. The first way, very simply, is excluding what is bad for the planet and for humans. So we ban weapons, we ban sovereign bonds from countries violating human rights, and we ban coal-based business models. The second way where we can implement our ESG ambition is investing massively in what is good. So low-income housing or renewable energy, where Allianz Group invests close to 7 billion euros. And the third way we can act is influence the way other companies do business by providing incentive. We believe at Allianz that companies which ignore sustainability today run the risk of raising negative sentiment among their own customers, among their employees, and run the risk eventually of becoming a stranded asset. So every Allianz entity today engages in discussions with investee companies to increase their level of ESG integration and transparency. Concretely, that means we help them review their governance, see how they monitor the ESG risks, how detailed their ESG disclosure is, and so on.
Marie Doha-Besancenot, Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests, Julie Norman and Somnath Battabile. Now, it's nearly 18 months since India, like many countries, walled itself off from international tourism. And this was a considerable sacrifice. In 2019, the last pre-pandemic year, India recorded nearly 18 million arrivals by international tourists and non-resident Indians, and India's tourism business was grateful for the money they spent. It has now been announced that India will once again issue visas visas for tourists arriving on chartered flights from October 15th and for all other flights from a month later. Somnath, is this, well, this is obviously going to be popular on an economic basis in India, but is it going to be popular otherwise? Because recently, certain major domestic events, sporting, religious and otherwise, have been blamed for localized spikes of COVID-19, haven't they?
Yeah. I think, again, as you said, the industry will welcome this. The tourism industry depends on people coming in. I can only talk about stories that I hear in conversation. It's been 2 years since almost 2 years that I haven't gone back. So, in a sense, I am looking forward to it. But in various parts of Bengal, Delhi, what I hear is locals really resisting people coming in. A friend of mine who's a long-term resident, an English couple, they were just picked up by the police when this COVID thing started because foreigners get it in. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories and unwelcome attention. Outside people who come in being forced into quarantine away from the neighborhoods they want to visit. So those stories are there. The first, as it starts, as people start coming in, if there is a spike, I fear that there might be a backlash against this. So, but that is the difficult side of it. India and other countries have to open up. I mean, this is the way the global capitalist system happens. The spikes have gone down. There is more capacity in hospitals now if the spikes go up. So I think it's about time that we test the waters, with the caveat that if things start to shoot up, it can be shut down again. We have to understand that this is not a normal situation. Things can't, So I hope the Modi government, which is extremely friendly towards capital, keeps that in mind.
We will come back to some of that shortly, but I did want to talk, Julie, about the fact that it's one thing to make it possible for visitors to go to India or indeed any other country. It's another thing entirely for those visitors to decide that that's where they want to go. And do you think India in particular does have a tricky sell at this point? Because in normal times, India as a place to visit absolutely sells itself. I mean, it's a fabulous country to visit. There's so much to see and so on. It's very high on most people's lists, and quite rightly. But it is now the case that only 20% of the country still has had two vaccinations. And are tourists going to be thinking of, is there an increased likelihood that I get this thing? And what are my options once there if I do?
Oh, I think tourists will certainly be weighing those kinds of decisions, and especially the fact that India had such a surge that came on very suddenly in the spring when, again, things seemed fine. Everyone was kind of going about their business, and then it just came on so quickly. And I think, hundreds of thousands of deaths during that time. And so there's that kind of history there, as well as this concern, is this a place where I might be around more people who are unvaccinated and likely to catch it? I think the other thing that this raises, too, is who even has the choice to be doing this kind of traveling beyond the usual privilege that we talk about. A lot of the travel and tourist visas will be limited to people who are vaccinated. So getting back to our earlier conversation, and again, that is still pretty limited to particular countries of the West. And so other people who may need to come to India a little bit more easily for work and family and whatnot will still be facing some restrictions if they don't have the vaccine.
Just to go back to something you were saying there, Somnath, about that idea that this is a fluid situation and further adjustments might have to be made, which is doubtless true, but not just in India, but generally, do you think that there's now a plurality of people in a lot of places who are just thinking, look, whatever at this point? I think we've reached the point at which, rightly or wrongly, it would be politically very difficult for any government, having lifted restrictions, to then start reimposing them.
Oh, I think that's a kind of dangerous suggestion, Andrew, that if it cannot be reimposed, if there is a spike like the Delta spike, which happened in India and things went on as normal, the deaths have been horrendous, the numbers. But one can only imagine if without any kind of state control, what it might be. There's another thought which I was having when I was thinking about this, is that do things have to go back to normal the way it was 2 or 3 years ago? You know, given the kind of conversation we are having on climate change, environment, do we need to do these foreign travels just for visiting foreign countries? You've seen enough images of the Taj Mahal, for God's sake, you know, do you really need to go? You know, I've seen giraffes run away in South Africa. Why do we need to do this? You need to visit relatives and friends. All three of us are migrants, and they need to go back home for certain reasons. But, you know, this incessant travel, which I am surely guilty of, and most of us are, but, you know, do things have to go back similar way, or can we raise tariffs on planes so much that people travel a bit less?
Well, let's move on to a
quickly moving.
Let's move on to, well, this situation could yet escalate. Let's move on to what is hopefully a much more trivial subject, because observers of Southeast Asian politics will be well aware that it does not take much to provoke the huffing, puffing, declaiming and accusing, which are the hallmarks of the diplomatic spat. It would nevertheless be remarkable if ambassadors ended up being withdrawn and or slung out over a curry. While no governments as such have as yet piled into this one, the facts of a matter being flammed up by excitable media in Japan and South Korea, and indeed North Korea, are these. A restaurant in Okinoshima has served a seafood curry containing rice patties shaped like the Takashima Islands, with a little Japanese flag in. The islands are known to Koreans as Dokdo. South Korea controls them, but North Korea also takes a proprietal interest. Julie, the obvious question prompted by this is, who the hell cares? But certain newspapers in Japan, and especially South Korea, are banking on the fact that their readers will. So why is this worth making a thing of?
Well, I guess it's worth making a thing. I mean, it went viral very quickly, and food and culture matter to people. And I think people take it quite seriously when they feel that that's being used in a way to score political points. I've got to say that I was very fascinated about the ability of, like, multiple productions of this, like, perfectly shaped, like, rice pile in the curry. Like, that just seems like a very hard thing to, like, reproduce over and over.
So yeah, I did wonder if they've had like a little mold. Like a mold commissioned.
Exactly. Yeah. That was more my question with this.
And that would need to be a bespoke item, unless you can imagine that perhaps in a fit of patriotic zeal in Japan, there will now be a mass market for rice molds shaped like what are either the Takashima or the Dokdo Islands. I'm trying not to offend anybody, and also I don't care. There you are. Now I've just upset everybody. Somnath, things like this, though, isn't there always a risk that the country complaining about it runs the risk of, I mean, they get their grievance across, but it can look a bit undignified, can't it? Like, when the islands were included on a map of Japan in the build-up to the Tokyo Olympics, South Korea threw a massive fit over that. I looked this up. They're not even islands. They're rocks. They are home to one permanent civilian resident, a few dozen Republic of Korea coast guards, and some people who manage the lighthouse.
Okay, I'm going to take this slightly seriously. I know you're making this a joke, right? So the history matters, right? So the Japanese history in the Second World War in Korea is quite grotesque and
nobody
very
is, nobody is denying
right?
that.
Right? So, I mean, my only knowledge of it comes from a novel called Pachinko, which I commend very highly. But here is the point. Given the long English colonialism, the way the English make their curries, I get really upset, you see? So that's the point. You know? Food matters, and nationalism in that through food, you know, there is a point.
This is not so much a question about the dish itself, which by the way, looks excellent. Just judging from the photos, it looks terrific. It is about the shape of it. And again, Julie, a South Korean newspaper, Dong-A Ilbo, which is making a thing of this, did manage to scare up a professor who was willing to call it a typical cheap trick of the Japanese, I assume he was impugning there. Whereas one North Korean outlet, and they can always be relied upon to be somewhat excitable, North Korean media, said, "We cannot help but be appalled by the meanness unique to this island nation." See, it's my contention that they can help but be appalled. They could just decide to go, you know what? Big deal.
They certainly could, but I think if you want to look for a fight, look for a food fight, and that's what they're doing. And you just can't resist the little flag that was put in the rice on some of them. I mean, it was just asking for it, you know.
I mean, do you think, Somnath, that South and indeed North Korean restaurateurs should retort in kind? Could they stake some? I assume there's some sort of other territorial dispute that they could pile in on here, and they could start making, or they could make their own little rice patty molds and put North or South Korean or both flags in.
See,
them.
I mean, North Korea could go ballistic about this. Better do a rice mound, you know, resembling one of the Japanese islands than, you know, throw a real nuke at them. So,
well,
food fights are good.
That is true enough, and we should probably avoid the phrase "going ballistic" where North Korea.
Indeed. I take it back.
May give them ideas.
slip of tongue.
If we have any regular listeners in Pyongyang, and hi, if you can hear us. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panelists today, Julie Norman and Somnath Battabile. And don't forget that tickets are still available to the Monocle Media Summit here in London on Thursday, which will include, among many other attractions, a live broadcast of this very program. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Monocle Media Summit is back. Join our editors for a look at the brands, correspondents, and titles that are shaping the media landscape and steering its future. This year, the event will also mark Monocle 24's 10th birthday, so we're putting a special focus on broadcast media. A packed afternoon of panels will once again be hosted by Monocle's founder Tyler Brulé and editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck, along with colleagues from print and radio. The session will feature insights from a stellar lineup of industry leaders, like CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward, Bild-Zeitung's deputy editor and chief international reporter Paul Ronsheimer, Zeit Magazine's Christoph Ament, author and researcher Jess Henderson, Finnish TV anchor Matti Ronka, and his BBC TV and radio counterpart Michel Hussein. Plus, there's a chance to watch a special live broadcast of the Monocle Daily on location. And after that, you can meet and talk shop with the speakers and the Monocle crew over drinks. The Monocle Media Summit is taking place on Thursday, the 14th of October, at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill Hotel, W1. As a Monocle listener, you can get 10% off your ticket. Head to monocle.com now and enter the promo code M24Birthday. We look forward to seeing you there.